Federalists off the rails. In 1793, the Supreme Court decided the case of Chisholm versus Georgia, and here the court began a career of grabbing at more power than the Constitution had been intended to give it. What the court did essentially was to decide that it had jurisdiction over a kind of case over which Article III did not give it jurisdiction, and its reasoning was essentially, well, somebody has to decide this case, and so we're the logical ones to do it. Which was completely contrary to the idea of a written constitution, enumerating a few types of cases that the federal courts would be able to decide. So what happened in Chisholm versus Georgia was that a man from South Carolina sued Georgia in a federal court over the question of the right to inherit an estate. Georgia refused to answer the case, asserting sovereign immunity. In other words, Georgia said, we're not party to this suit. We don't consent to be hauled into court. Georgia is a sovereign state and is immune from suit unless it condescends to allow itself to be impleaded. Chief Justice John Jay and Justice James Wilson said Georgia was no longer sovereign for the purposes of the Union, and that this case was one of those purposes. Congress within a few months sent the 11th Amendment out to the states for their ratification. What the 11th Amendment said essentially was that a state could not be a party, could not be sued in federal court. Made explicit that federal courts had no jurisdiction over cases like Chisholm versus Georgia. And one would have thought that this question had already been decided by omission of this kind of case from the list of cases. That Congress could empower federal courts to decide in Article III, and certainly if it hadn't been decided by that omission, it ought to have been decided by the 10th Amendment, but apparently the federal judges in the Federalist era were not satisfied with that kind of reasoning, and so the 11th Amendment became necessary. In 1798, the Federalists on the Supreme Court issued another decision that was going to have notable effect. It did three things. One was it dispositively decided the meaning of the ex post facto clause, the ban on states adopting ex post facto laws, that is. It presaged the decision in Marbury versus Madison, which the Supreme Court would claim what some lower federal courts had already claimed, which was the power of judicial review. And it included a very significant debate between two of the justices, two of the founding father justices, over the role of courts in the American Republican type of political system. What happened here once again was a will was at issue, and this Connecticut will was contested. The Connecticut legislature overturned the lower court's ruling in the case and sent the case back to the lower court for a retrial. This sounds peculiar, but in the colonial period and in the early Republican period, Connecticut's legislature had acted more or less as the Supreme Court of Connecticut with power to remand cases. It didn't tend to issue legal rulings, but it did send cases back to lower courts occasionally for retrial. So the Calders, who were frustrated heirs in this case, challenged the Connecticut legislature's remand on the basis of the ex post facto clause. They said essentially that what was happening here was that an act of legislature had changed the law, and so this amounted to legislation changing the law retrospectively. As I said, the Supreme Court upheld the Connecticut legislature's right to do this, because as in colonial times, it was simply acting as the highest legislature of the state. But Justice Chase went on and on in his opinion about political theory, a very long, rambling kind of paragraph in which he talked about he considered the relationship between Republican government and the power of legislatures. And what he said was that there were some principles that Republican legislature couldn't validly violate. There were some lines it couldn't cross, even where the people had not expressly limited the legislature's power in that regard. And The actual language from Justice Chase is, quote, "I cannot subscribe to the omnipotence of a state legislature, or that it is absolute and without control. Although its authority should not be expressly restrained by the Constitution or fundamental law of the state, the nature and ends of legislative power will limit the exercise of it. This fundamental principle flows from the very nature of our free republican governments." So notice what Chase was doing here was issuing a theoretical, a philosophical statement, not based in any kind of law, but as he was saying, is an alternative to law. "There are acts," Chase continued, "which the federal, state, or federal or state legislature cannot do without exceeding their authority. There are certain vital principles in our free republican governments which will determine and overrule an apparent and flagrant abuse of legislative power." Now notice, by saying this, Chase was claiming for himself, and one infers for his fellow justices, the right to come in and say that not the legislature, but the judiciary was the ultimate enforcer of republicanism in the United States, or not the legislature, but the judiciary was supreme among the three branches. Of course, ultimately, it would be up to the sovereign people to make constitutional amendments or to lay out a new constitution. So the ultimate authority always lay with the people. But Chase was saying, essentially, there's an alternative to enforcing the Constitution, and that is enforcing my idea of the proper political science. Quote, "An act of the legislature, for I cannot call it a law, contrary to the great first principles of the social compact, cannot be considered a rightful exercise of legislative authority." Now notice again, the great first principles of the social compact, where do we find those? Well, Chase was finding them in his own head or in his own heart. They had nothing to do with, and he was positing that they might even be contrary to the provisions of the Constitution. "The legislature," he concluded, "may enjoin, permit, forbid, and punish. They may declare new crimes and establish rules of conduct for all their citizens in future cases. They may command what is right and prohibit what is wrong, but they cannot change innocence into guilt, or punish innocence as a crime, or violate the right of an antecedent lawful private contract, or the right of private property. To maintain that our federal or state legislature possesses such powers would be a political heresy, altogether inadmissible in our free republican governments." So what Chase was effectively saying was, it may be that the people in making the Constitution and making laws through their legislature have adopted one policy, but it's possible that I would decide that this policy was simply impermissible and I wasn't going to allow it to be enforced. This elicited a response from one of Justice Chase's colleagues. Justice Chase had been a prominent anti-federalist in Maryland before changing stripes and being appointed by President Washington to the Supreme Court. Justice James Iredell had been perhaps the leading Federalist in North Carolina, both in the Prince and in the ratification conventions. They had two in North Carolina. Justice Iredell responded to Chase's little soliloquy or his disquisition, depending whether you're listening to it or reading it, that while a federal court could declare an unconstitutional law void, it should only do so, quote, "in a clear and urgent case. Such a case would not be one in which the court's idea of natural justice was violated alone because, quote, the ideals of natural justice are regulated by no fixed standard. The ablest and the purest men have differed upon the subject. And all that the court could properly say in such an event would be that the legislature, possessed of an equal right of opinion, had passed an act which, in the opinion of the judges, was inconsistent with the abstract principles of natural justice." Now notice, Justice Iredell's idea was that the legislature was, quote, possessed of an equal right of opinion, unquote, about what were good principles and true with the justices. This is a way of thinking of these things that's entirely contrary to what we've become accustomed to in America in the early 21st century. I mean, now it's long been the case that the justices feel free to strike down public policy made by the elected branches or made by appointed people outside the judiciary on the ground that those policies violate what they call, quote, the evolving standards of decency of society. So that's a cover for saying that they're going to act like Justice Chase. But Justice Iredell's principle that it was not for the judges to be choosing public policy, and it was not for them to be enforcing what they took to be principles of what he calls the idea of natural justice alone. This was more consistent with republicanism as laid out in a constitution that established three separate branches of government, each with limited functions. I mean, what Iredell was essentially saying was, we're not going to be involved in legislating. And what Chase was saying was, well, the ultimate decision maker is going to be yours truly, Samuel Chase. Another episode in that same year further elucidated the Federalist understanding of the Constitution, and that was the Alien and Sedition Acts crisis. Actually, the Alien and Sedition Acts crisis had its immediate antecedents in 1797 and wouldn't ultimately be concluded until the swearing in of President Jefferson and his first acts as president in March of 1801. Essentially, what had happened was that in 1797, the Federalist grand jury in Richmond had indicted a congressman in Virginia for seditious libel, and which is a common law offense of saying things that tended to bring the government into ill repute. In 1798, Congress went further. It adopted three laws intended to tamp down political opposition to the foreign policy and the military buildup that had been launched by the Adams administration: the Alien Enemies Act, the Alien Friends Act, and the Sedition Act. The Alien Enemies Act remains in effect today. What it essentially does is entitle or empower the president to imprison or expel hostile, that is, alien enemies in time of conflict. And this has never really been controversial. The Alien Friends Act empowered the president to expel dangerous aliens. So Republicans were going to have their objections to this. How would you know an alien was dangerous? Well, it would have to be on the basis of what he said, what he wrote, or with whom he associated, how he might participate in public assemblies. And these were all rights that the Republicans said were protected, even in the case of aliens, by the First Amendment to the Federal Constitution. So they said this was unconstitutional, besides which they said the Alien Friends Act assumed that the president would both identify and expel these dangerous aliens. And so what it did was to eliminate the protection of the checks and balances established by the creation of three separate branches of government. That is, it cut the judiciary out of what should have been its role. So notice that the Republicans were claiming that procedural protections and substantive protections provided to American citizens by the federal Constitution were also provided by the federal Constitution to aliens. This is an idea that periodically has been controversial in American history ever since. The third of these Alien and Sedition Acts, though, was the one that was really most widely controversial and resisted. That was the Sedition Act. What the Sedition Act did was to outlaw sedition, including seditious libel. So it became now a statutory fact of American life that it was a federal crime to say anything that tended to bring the government into ill repute. And by say, of course, is meant both express orally and express in writing, anything that tended to bring the government into ill repute. Once again, the Republicans argued that this was unconstitutional because it violated the freedoms of speech, press, and assembly protected in Article 1 of the Constitution. But what was going to be more important as far as the Republicans were concerned was that it violated the 10th Amendment principle that the federal Congress couldn't do anything that the Constitution didn't say it could do. So, were these just theoretical problems? Was this is the fact that I'm devoting attention to it just a sign that liberal college professors tend to imagine parades of horribles wherever they see the government alive? And the answer is, well, no, because there was actually active enforcement of the Alien and Sedition Acts. The Alien Enemies Act, as said, is still in effect. The Alien Friends Act was never used and ultimately expired, but that doesn't mean it didn't frighten people. And actually, apparently, it did frighten people out of saying things or out of participating in political life in America. The Sedition Act was the ground of numerous prosecutions. A couple of dozen people and more were targeted under the Sedition Act, and ultimately, everybody who was prosecuted was convicted. and everybody who was convicted was given a substantial sentence. Vice President Jefferson himself was fearful of prosecution, as he confided to another prominent Virginia politician, sometime Virginia Senator John Taylor of Caroline, in a letter late in 1798. He was worried, he said, about the postmasters, and he thought people might read his mail, so he couldn't say anything critical of the Adams administration. He found this a burden, just a problematic, worrisome, a terrible situation in the United States. What response, then, might the Republicans choose to the Alien Sedition Acts? Well, the response took the form of the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions. And the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions were adopted by the Republicans as their counter strategy, because they couldn't rely on the federal executive to pardon people convicted under the Sedition Act. John Adams, after all, was the one who had signed them. So they couldn't count on Congress to repeal the act. They couldn't count on the federal judiciary not to enforce the acts. And actually, the federal judiciary was very energetically enforcing the acts. And so at a meeting in Monticello, which was Jefferson's estate outside Charlottesville in central Western Virginia, in 1798, they decided that both the Virginia and Kentucky legislatures would adopt legislative resolutions laying out the ground for, or the ground of, Republican opposition to the acts. And the Kentucky resolutions of 98 were drafted by Jefferson and very forcefully stated that the federal government was created by the states for only a few purposes. Those purposes were enumerated. The basic principle of the Constitution was that whatever powers weren't delegated by the Constitution to the federal government or denied by it to the states were reserved to the states respectively or to the people. And this meant that the Alien Act was unconstitutional. In case Jefferson's draft said, in case the federal government launched on a policy that was unconstitutional and dangerous, quote, a nullification is the rightful remedy, without saying exactly what a nullification was. The Virginia resolutions, drafted by James Madison, made the exact same argument. What they said was that states created the federal government, gave it a few powers, enumerated them. Whatever powers weren't granted were reserved, and as Madison put it, states have the right and are in duty bound to interpose to prevent the enforcement of unconstitutional and dangerous laws, quote, within their respective territories. Now, today it's very common for Straussian and other statist historians to say that, well, what Madison contemplated, what Virginia contemplated, was cooperation among the states to prevent enforcement of the Sedition Act, not action by a unit, by an individual state. But it's hard to square that claim with the Virginia resolution's assertion that it was the state's responsibility to protect, that is, they have the right and are in duty bound to interpose to prevent the enforcement of these policies, quote, within their respective territories. Respective. What? Why do you need interstate cooperation? Or if you were contemplating interstate cooperation as sole means of facilitating interposition, would you say anything about the respective territories of the states, or would you just say in America? After all, if the states are cooperating, respective territories don't have anything to do with it. The other states were called upon by Virginia's and Kentucky's legislatures to endorse these positions, but they didn't. In fact, south of Virginia, you had no state issuing an official statement. In North Carolina, one house voted to endorse the resolutions. The other house voted or refused to do so, and so you didn't have any outcome. North of Virginia, however, nine states contradicted the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions. And most forcefully, in the cases of Massachusetts and Connecticut, they said that we like the Sedition Act, we wish it had been adopted sooner, we hope there are more prosecutions. It's not for state governments to be interpreting the Constitution. It's not true that the states created the federal government. That was done by the American people through their ratification conventions, and the state governments had nothing to do with it. And so ultimately, we don't want to hear any more of this. Well, having heard these answers, Virginia and Kentucky decided to respond. In 1799, Virginia's legislature adopted a second set of legislative resolutions, this time clarifying its position in light of protests from north of Virginia and Kentucky. And the most interesting portions of the Kentucky resolutions of 1799, which seem to have been outlined by Jefferson but weren't drafted by Jefferson, were a few. One, Kentucky said, essentially, we love the Union for the purposes for which it was created. And note, for those purposes. So they also said that they would be among the first, among the last to secede. Well, that, you know, showed that they were contemplating secession, as pulling out of the Union as a possible response to continued enforcement of the Sedition Act. And an even stronger response was issued by Virginia's legislature. There, former Congressman James Madison came out of retirement and sought election to the lower house of the legislature. Then here you have James Madison in the lower house of the legislature. Why? Well, because he intended to become the sponsor of what were called what was called the Report of 1799, Madison's report, and ultimately the Report of 1800 was the name that people knew it by. And what Madison did there was not just to answer what people had said about the Virginia resolutions of 1798, but to go through all of the behavior of the Federalists in the 1790s and say why it was unconstitutional from the point of view of the Republicans. So we have an argument here against the Bank Bill of 1791, against the Neutrality Proclamation, against the Alien and Sedition Acts, and so on. And Madison also, while he was at it, answered the complaints or the points made by the critics, notably, again, in Connecticut and Massachusetts. And what he said there was that statement that the states didn't create the Union, the American people did through their ratification conventions, assumed an invalid definition of the word states, or assumed the wrong definition of the word states, right? To say, well, the states didn't do that, state governments had nothing to do with that, assume that when the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions of 98 had used the word states, they were referring to the governments. But Madison says in the report of 1800, the word states is susceptible of several different definitions. When you use the word state, you may be referring to the territory of a state. As I might say, this afternoon I'm going to fly to North Carolina, right? I'm going to fly to the state of North Carolina. There I'd be referring to the territory of the state. Or I might say, it is the policy of the state of Vermont that gays may marry, right? Well, that refers to the government of Vermont. Or finally, I might say, the state of Virginia ratified the Constitution. And Madison said, when we used the word state in 1798, we had in mind that third signification. We were talking about the sovereign people of the state. It is the sovereign peoples of the individual states that agreed to live under the Constitution through the Article 7 process, and that's what we meant when we said that the states created the federal government. He thought there's really no doubt about that. Now, how are we to understand the political context of the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions? Well, I think we can do that by looking at two letters from Vice President Jefferson to Taylor. That's again, sometimes Senator John Taylor of Caroline. Very interesting, leading figure in the Republican hierarchy in Virginia, but throughout the country. You can see him as being just at one level below Thomas Jefferson and James Madison in the national Republican hierarchy. In a letter that Jefferson wrote to Taylor on June 4th, 1798, Jefferson said essentially that it was true that the Massachusetts and Connecticut ride us very hard, but he said, I think the reign of witches will pass. And he was confident that the American people would return to their old Republican ways. November 26, 1798, Jefferson sent a second letter, and there's the one in which he said he was really chagrined by the fact that he had to be worried about what he said in his mail. But he also said he thought that an end to the delusion was coming, that a cure was on its way in the person of, or with the ministrations of Dr. Taxman. So he thought essentially that once the taxman arrived at people's doors to pay for the military buildup, to collect the taxes that the Federalist Congress had passed to pay for the military buildup, well, then the fever would break and people would realize, you know, we don't want a bigger Navy, we don't want a big army, we don't want to pay all these taxes, we don't want people thrown in jail for criticizing these taxes and the foreign policy that they're supposed to support. And so Jefferson predicted that what would happen was, at that point, people would vote for the Republicans. In 1800, course, and this whole campaign had been directed at the American people. It wasn't thought that Federalists in Congress or in the Massachusetts legislature were going to change their minds and decide they believed in freedom of speech just because the Republicans pointed out how the Constitution had been created. But in the election of 1800, as Jefferson had predicted to Taylor, the Republicans won for the first time control of the White House and control of both houses of Congress. And Jefferson, as I said, had predicted that the tax issue would sweep Republicans to victory. But once the victory had been won, Jefferson's explanation changed. And at the end of his life, he referred to what he called the Revolution of 1800. The Revolution of 1800, he said, was as real a revolution in the principles of our government as that of 76 was in its form. So in other words, what had happened here, according to Jefferson, was that the American people at the ballot boxes or through their state legislatures casting electoral votes, or ultimately through the House of Representatives choosing Jefferson to be president over his running mate Aaron Burr, they had validated Republican principles. And so we should understand that the Republican principles about the Constitution were the valid ones, the ones that the people had in mind when they created the Constitution. And of course, I believe that this is largely true, that the version of the Constitution that the Republicans stood for in the election of 1800 actually was virtually congruent with what the Federalists had said, spurred by people like Governor Edmund Randolph, George Nicholas, and James Madison in 1788.